The town of Harvey might be facing bankruptcy in part because of its pension bill. Civic Federation President Lawrence Massal says the state has a responsibility to help.
The state of Illinois, which doesn't have a lot of moral standing to argue with Harvey because the state hasn't always made its pension contributions, does have a responsibility to the citizens of Harvey.
Plus, since January, thousands of 16 and 17-year-olds have signed up to be on the organ donor registry, including 17-year-old Jacob Lencini.
Recently, we got to meet the man with our father's heart and the man with our father's lungs. It gives people hope.
It's Jacob speaking to ABC 7 Chicago about his father, Chris, who was also an organ donor. How are teen donors helping Illinois' organ recipients? And when you think about Midwest food, there's cheese, corn, soy, but what about shrimp? Scientists and farmers have been exploring raising saltwater fish in states like Illinois. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking about how farming saltwater fish like shrimp right here in Illinois could be a help not just to our economy, but the environment. And we'll be checking in on Illinois' organ donor list. Now that more than 10,000 16 and 17-year-olds have signed up to be donors under a new state law. But first, Illinois passed a state budget last week. It was done on time and appears to be balanced. That's a far cry from what has happened for the past 2 years when a budget impasse plunged our state into a fiscal crisis. And while lawmakers, credit rating agencies, and organizations like the Civic Federation are applauding the actions involved in passing that balanced budget, the state still has longstanding fiscal issues. Among them, massive obligations owed to pensions, especially for local firefighters and police officers. The suburban Chicago towns of Harvey and North Chicago are running low on cash and could be facing bankruptcy precisely because of this pension debt. I'm joined now by Liz Farmer. She's been covering this issue in her role as a staff writer who writes about public finance for Governing Magazine. She's on the line from Washington, D.C. Also with us from Chicago is Lawrence Massal, where he's president of the Civic Federation. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's start with just this bigger question, if we can, Lawrence, and that's what it means and if it's possible for towns to file for bankruptcy here in Illinois.
Well, it's possible. The federal government reserves to each state the mechanism by which they would allow their municipalities to seek bankruptcy protection. In Illinois, it requires a majority of the Illinois House and the Illinois Senate to approve a resolution authorizing a specific municipality to file for bankruptcy protection. That would then allow them to file in the federal court system. Illinois has never granted that authority. Mostly what the state has attempted to do is treat any municipality that's in financial difficulty as a one-off. Probably the most recognized in the state was the East St. Louis situation over the last few decades. Basically, the state has provided a separate finance oversight authority to help them deal with their problems, but they have never granted them authority for filing for bankruptcy.
And Liz, you specifically reported on Harvey for Governing Magazine. Can you describe what the current fiscal state of Harvey is right now?
The biggest problem with Harvey is that it has been mismanaged for many, many years. Obviously, we know about the corruption in its past, you know, and its mayor, and it, which is still an issue today, its current mayor cannot go to the bond market to borrow money. He has been banned for life. And so when you have something that dark and scary, I mean, that really says a lot about what a city's baseline is. And so Harvey does not make enough money to afford the services it is supposed to provide for its citizens. It is constantly spending more money than it makes. I think we all know on a personal level where that gets us. And in that sense, cities are no different. So Harvey has been running deficits for years, and in doing that has not been paying its pensions.
And then what happens legally in that situation when a city says we don't have the money to pay pensions?
Well, what is happening in Illinois is that pension boards are petitioning to the state, and through this law that was actually passed through the pension reform back in 2011, but got held up and regulations had, you know, took a few years to be written. So here we are today that now we have its actual first use in Harvey and in North Chicago. And so what's happening is the state is holding on to money that would otherwise go to the city through revenue sharing. theoretically, the state is going to hold enough money until it can put that money into what Harvey is supposedly owes this year for its pensions. That combined for the city of Harvey between its police and fire pensions is a combined $22 million that it is behind on payments. And that's what a court ruled a few years back. That is equivalent to what Harvey's budget is in an entire year. So the state's not going to hold that much money in reality. But again, there's this huge kind of conundrum as to the scale that Harvey is facing in terms of what it owes, how far behind it is in its pensions, and how much money it actually has.
And before we get to the scale of this and how it relates to other municipalities, Lawrence, can I just ask, as the state is doing this, holding these funds, these are sales tax revenue, property tax revenue, where is the state collecting this that it's holding it from?
This is primarily sales tax and income tax receipts that the state shares through the local government distribution fund to these governments. And so the state of Illinois collects sales tax and shares, including the municipal sales tax, and provides it back to the municipality proportionally, and they collect income tax and share through the local government distribution fund a percentage of that. And so it's income and sales tax that Harvey would otherwise get for its municipal purposes, but when they changed the police and fire pension laws about 6 years ago, they put in a requirement that if the municipality fails to make the pension contribution, the pension funds can seek interception by the state and have the money sent directly to the pension fund. And that's what's happening. About $1.8 million in the case of Harvey is being held by the comptroller. Instead of sent to fund Harvey operations, it's being intercepted with the expectation that it will be transferred to the pension funds. Harvey says it can't afford that transfer, so it is in litigation with the state of Illinois.
So it's essentially kind of like having your wages garnished, it sounds like, but they're doing
it's
that for
exactly
municipal.
It's exactly like that. In the case of the regular municipal pension fund, so the Illinois Municipal Retirement Fund has the authority to intercept municipal city sales and income tax if a municipality doesn't make its requisite contribution into the municipal pension fund. But this is a relatively new development because the law is only 6 years old or so for Illinois, and it is aimed at providing some security for the police and firemen who count on that pension fund to make the city contribute according to what the state law requires.
And Lawrence, I wonder if you can put this in the context. People, I think, probably for some time are familiar with the problems and the pension debt that the state holds at the state level. How is this different?
Well, it's only different in that the magnitude of the amount is less. It is caused by the same basic problem, that is that the state of Illinois, which created the municipal pension funds and the police and fire pension funds for Harvey and for other cities, holds those funds to the same accountability it does itself. Instead of funding according to what is actuarially required, they fund generally on a statutory basis. And so the problem sources are very similar. That is, we want to provide benefits, or we've enhanced benefits while we weren't making adequate contributions. Now that the pension funds have become grossly underfunded, it's becoming more acute, it's becoming more expensive. And so the state of Illinois, which doesn't have a lot of moral standing to argue with Harvey that they have to make their pension contributions because the state hasn't always made its pension contributions, does have a responsibility to the citizens of Harvey. The citizens of Harvey pay the highest property tax rates in the state of Illinois and now are receiving some of the dramatically lesser benefits. The Harvey has announced that they're cutting their fire department in half, and that means that they will have much less fire protection.
And Liz, as you talked to Lawrence about this, we mentioned Harvey, we mentioned North Chicago. What are we seeing across Illinois based on your reporting that you're seeing? Lawrence mentioned property taxes. That's the main way municipalities, I think, nowadays are seeing sources of revenue. Is that what we're seeing across the board, these property tax increases to afford these pension liabilities?
In some places, yes. In other places, they are taking out pension obligation bonds, so they're borrowing the money, basically. Danville, Illinois, already charged a public safety pension fee to households and businesses every year. They more than doubled that recently from $96 to $260 to $7 a year. They call it a public safety pension fee. I mean, it's which on the one hand, it kind of makes you laugh. But on the other hand, I mean, it's very transparent where that money is going to. As Lawrence mentioned, some places are really capped out in that area. And in Harvey, for example, has already been defaulting on debt. That's another thing that, you know, another option for cities is to default on debt if you don't have enough money to pay it. So there really needs to be some kind of more structured way for cities to handle this when this pressure keeps coming down.
Lawrence, you told Liz that Harvey is the tip of the iceberg. How many other towns do you think are in similar situations across Illinois?
Unfortunately, there are dozens of towns throughout Illinois that face very similar pension pressures, difficulty in making their contributions. We have examples, for example, that the city of Alton was going to sell its water treatment plant to cover just 1 year's pension contribution requirement. We don't know what they'll do next year after they sell the water treatment facility in order to pay that bill. Granite City took out a $20 million loan to fund its police and fire pensions and found that in a very short time they were not stabilized in their pension fund, but it actually deteriorated. So what local governments are being forced to do are make very difficult decisions. Property tax increases generally are not very popular. There is a lot of downward pressure. School districts primarily represent the bulk of most communities' property tax bill. And so when the municipalities need it to go pay for their pensions, they find a very difficult environment for it. It would be much better, and the Civic Federation has strongly advocated for the creation of a state authority similar to what we see in other states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, where the state recognizes that it has expertise and the ability to help local governments before they get into dire stress, before they start selling assets, before they basically find themselves questioning whether they can continue on or whether they need to file for bankruptcy protection. Instead, those states provide some financial oversight, some independent review. We've heard from aldermen in the city of Harvey who say they don't know just how bad the situation is in Harvey because Harvey does not provide transparency in its financial bookkeeping. It doesn't always provide the reports to the state comptroller that are required under state law, and the state doesn't force Harvey to provide that information. The reason why it's the tip of the iceberg is because so many of our local governments in Illinois, especially our police and fire pension funds, are grossly underfunded and are having a difficult time figuring out how to make both the payments to the pension fund and continue to provide the operating funds necessary to provide basic government service.
Liz, how does that work? To Lawrence's point, in places like Michigan, we've heard, I think people might have heard of Detroit's, obviously, bankruptcy filing, but I'm thinking about Benton Harbor and other towns that were under emergency oversight.
Michigan and a few other states have an emergency manager system. And so when a city starts coming up upon financial hardship, the state has an opportunity to step in and install somebody to kind of, it's basically a financial takeover. And so they're controversial always because a lot of times there's a racial issue. A lot of times local officials don't want to give up power, yet they don't really have to. It really is kind of a state takeover. We saw that all of that stuff play out in Detroit, which was a very sped up version of the whole process and had a bankruptcy on the end of it. Most places stay under emergency management for several years, maybe a decade. Flint, I think, just exited, and I want to say it was maybe 6 or 7 years under an emergency manager. So that's kind of more typical of what you find in other states with something like that in place. There are other states like Pennsylvania, which has a system where they're under state financial oversight. Pittsburgh just exited after, I think, almost 2 decades under state oversight. Harrisburg was as well. Harrisburg actually tried to file for bankruptcy, but the state said it couldn't. So it's a controversial system always, but it is at least something, right? And in Illinois right now, there isn't anything.
Lawrence, we are almost out of time, but I just wondered briefly if you could mention what policy recommendations the Civic Federation has for helping fix this or make this better in Illinois.
Well, the Civic Federation has strongly supported House Bill 2575 that Representative David Harris had sponsored. It's called the Local Government Protection Authority. It's aimed at recognizing the state's responsibility to do more than just watch the local governments struggle, to actually help them by providing resources, providing some financial expertise, providing them the opportunity to have their issues resolved by an independent board, by basically making that tough decision. Is it a revenue problem? Is it an expense problem? Is there some combination that can stabilize these governments? What we're seeing in Illinois, because the state has a hard time balancing its own budget and funding its own pensions, it has not exerted the authority that it may have done in the past with East St. Louis and other communities that struggled. But now we're seeing local governments like Harvey and others that are forced to make terribly difficult decisions, not necessarily to the best interest of the taxpayers and to the citizens there, without any help from the state of Illinois. And that is not a sustainable process going forward.
Lawrence, how do you get lawmakers interested in taking up this legislation?
Clearly, the legislators, now that they have the governor signed the budget yesterday and the legislature, members of the General Assembly are returning to their communities, hopefully they will pay attention to the local officials who have been warning for some time the financial distress they're under. The Illinois Municipal League had a package of legislation that they introduced that would have benefited statewide consolidation of our pension funds. The way the legislature pays attention to something is if the public brings it to their attention and presses them for an answer. We're hopeful that the members of the General Assembly, now that they completed their second budget in 4 years, will turn their attention to helping local governments, which desperately need help from many of the problems created by the state legislature over the last few decades.
We solved one thing, lots of other problems to solve. That's Lawrence Missal, who's president of the Civic Federation. I want to thank him, along with Liz Farmer, a staff writer with Governing Magazine in Washington, D.C. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you went out for dinner this weekend and for seafood, maybe you scanned the menu to see where some of the items were from. It's a habit we have when we're looking at seafood, right? Were the oysters from Maine? Was the salmon from Washington? Did you see any shrimp from Indiana? It is possible to have seafood raised in the Midwest. As scientists and farmers are exploring more ways to raise saltwater fish like shrimp in landlocked states like ours, and it may not only be more sustainable, it could also mean big dollars. RDM Shrimp has been raising Pacific white shrimp many miles from the ocean in Fowler, that's in northwest Indiana. One of its owners, Carlena Brown, is on the line with us now. Hi, Carlena. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Also joining us from Indiana's Purdue University is the school's aquaculture research manager, Bob Rohde. Hi, Bob. Thanks for being here as well.
Glad to be here.
Carlena, how did RDM first begin? This was back in 2010, right?
Yes. How we began was actually through my husband. He was looking at raising tilapia and found a shrimp system that was a whole lot cheaper than raising tilapia, and that's how we went forward.
And
also with the impression there were hundreds of these across the U.S.
Yeah, how did you pick? Why did you pick shrimp?
For him, for me, it was a no-brainer. Shrimp tastes better than tilapia, and they're easier to clean. So that's my concept of it. But for him, they just wanted a small system where they had livestock on the farm. That's all they were looking for. And shrimp system was about half the cost of getting into tilapia.
Mm. And Bob, you helped teach Carlena and her husband about shrimp farming technology. How tough is it to get started in this?
It is tough to get started. The technology is a pretty new technology. They're using what's called a BioFlock system, which is new and innovative, and part of the thing is it is low cost to get involved. So that's the appeal to most people, but the management is rather difficult. It's a touchy system in terms of management. It takes, Carlina can tell you, it takes quite a while to master how to control the bacteria that clean the water.
Carlina, how much land and how much space do you need for your shrimp farm?
It depends on what size you're wanting to go with. We're on about an acre, not even. I have a total of about 12,000 square feet in the building.
And how much shrimp are you raising from that?
We actually average about 500 pounds per month go out our front door for retail sales and about another 150 in wholesale.
Wow. And how long did it take to get everything up and running, Carlina?
For us, it took us over 2 years before we got the bioflock to actually balance out to where we could actually start getting good survival rates. And we're now at a very steady between 70 and 90% survival rate for our production side.
Both of you have used that word, bioflock. Bob, what does that mean?
So bioflock is a, it comes from two words. Bio obviously means living, and flock is what you think of, a floating kind of material in the water column. Well, in this case, that floating material is made up of colonies of different things, mostly bacteria, but also very small organisms, and they all clump together in this flock. And the major benefit for the shrimp production is that they take the waste products of the shrimp, basically ammonia, and they convert it from ammonia to a less toxic form of nitrogen, nitrate. And that's really what keeps the shrimp basically alive. If you just left them to live in their own waste, it would ultimately euthanize them just based on the amount of ammonia they produce.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the treatment system to clean up the water, and it looks, it's hard to describe what it looks like, but it looks kind of like a murky tannish color in the water column.
And Bob, I think when people hear about farmed fish, and Carlene, I'd love for you to weigh in after Bob, I think people sometimes think about I think sometimes farm fish has gotten kind of a bad reputation for how sustainable it is or its effects on the environment. How are you all producing this? And Bob, how are you teaching folks to do this?
So yeah, especially with shrimp, they are a warm water species, so they have to be kept inside because of our winters here. And so we definitely are recycling as much as possible. We use this bioflock system to keep reusing the water. We're basically treating the water and reusing it, as well as they are marine organisms. And although not very many, I don't think anybody really uses straight salt water, you do have to add salt to the water to make it at least brackish. And that's expensive as well. So you want to keep reusing that as much as you can. So it's all about treating and reusing as much as you can. And then all the farm-raised fish we grow, or shrimp, are raised on commercial processed diets, which part of the components are, soybeans and corn, things that we have around here. The other thing that's about the sustainability of it, you know, most of our shrimp here in the U.S. comes from overseas. And so I forget what they call it, but the mileage on this,
yeah, they're being flown in.
Short, mm-hmm. Yes, right. So it's just more sustainable that way as well.
Carlina, what else do you say to folks who worry about the health of farmed fish?
The fact that most of the time they're actually healthier than what you're eating in from other places, because we actually do care about our water and what we're doing. So we want to make sure that we're providing the most healthiest product that we can supply.
And who are you supplying your product to, Carlina?
Most of ours go to people walking in our front door, and they drive on average anywhere from 2 to 3 hours to come and get our product. We do supply to some grocery stores and restaurants from time to time.
Including in Illinois, right, Carlina?
Correct. Actually, Illinois was the only state that would actually take our product with the head on, because we choose not to process our product. This way we can guarantee you the freshness of the product by selling it with the head on. And we actually had the Harvest Market there in Champaign, and we were on the menu at the Marriott in Chicago.
Wow. And as we talk about that, I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation, thinking about what this looks like. And we know there's a lot of freshwater fish production in Illinois, but we have someone from the Illinois Department of Natural Resources on the line with us. Nathan Greider is the aquaculture project specialist on the line from Springfield. Hi, Nathan. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
As you're listening to Carlena and Bob talk about their set, Bob sort of given us a little explanation of the setup in Indiana. What does it look like? What does Illinois' aquaculture industry look like?
Well, right now we have about 70 licensed aquaculture facilities in the state, and those are all producing freshwater species of some kind. We do not require a permit for species that only live in saltwater. So if it can survive in freshwater, such as striped bass, then there is a permit required. But for strictly saltwater species, we don't require a permit. The idea or the premise of that is that if they were to get out into the environment, they wouldn't survive anyways. So the main objective of our program is protecting the state's natural resources from any releases or non-native species that might be introduced from aquaculture. So saltwater is considered to be a low risk to the state resources as far as them escaping.
Right, because they certainly couldn't survive. Do we have a sense of how many saltwater programs there are throughout Illinois?
Well, since we don't require a permit, I couldn't say the exact number, but I don't think it's very many. I get a few calls now and then of people asking what permits they would need for saltwater, such as shrimp or lobster. And they're mostly small hobbyist type people. I'm not aware of any larger, corporate or bulk producers of saltwater in Illinois. I would say there's a handful of hobbyists, small productions in the state. Not very many, but I can't say the exact number.
Bob, I wonder how much how important you think it is to encourage seafood production inland here in the Midwest.
Well, it's it's very important if you think of it even nationally. You know, the USDA came out with recommendations just a couple years ago that we should be eating, I forget, it's 2 servings of fish per week, and we're averaging 1. And so to double the amount of fish we eat, that's got to come from somewhere. And obviously, you know, you can import it, or you can bring it in from the coast, or you can grow it here. And just to reach that target to maintain healthy diets, we'd need a lot more fish produced here to meet that demand.
Mm-hmm. And so, Nathan, I imagine, as to Bob's point, most of the fish that we are getting, even into the U.S., is imported, correct, from farming and other places?
Yeah, I would say the majority. Most of the fish produced in Illinois, there are some going to food markets. There's about 23 tilapia producers in Illinois, smaller operations. And then we do have a few farms that are in a cooperative agreement with Southern Illinois University Carbondale that produce largemouth bass and I believe they're hybrid striped bass for food markets. So, again, not very large productions, mostly utilizing their ponds on their own property. And then the rest of the bulk of the permits issued are to farms that raise fish for stocking in lakes and private ponds, so recreational use make up the most of the others. Bluegill, largemouth bass, channel catfish, and those common species.
And all of those, again, freshwater, correct?
Correct, freshwater.
Yeah. Carlena, and when you're talking about your shrimp in RDM, you also provide shrimp to other farmers. How do you help other farmers learn how to do this?
We actually supply what we call PL60s or feeder shrimp. We will get them from a hatchery when they're about 10 days old, and then we will raise them up to 60 days. So we take off that first 2 months of production for them, and then they can just raise them out and sell them out their door for the first 3 months. It helps them build the bacterial water up faster. It also helps them sell the shrimp out the door faster.
And where are you, who are you sending that out to? Is that going all across the Midwest or the country?
They have to be within a 24-hour driving period. So we basically go from Nebraska to Boston and from Minnesota down to Texas.
Wow, so that's a pretty big range for your shrimper going.
Yeah, we supply right now to 11 shrimp farms across the U.S. But we, at the end of 1 year, we train them on how to do the nursery side of it, so then they start their own nurseries, and they will get their own PLs from the hatchery in Florida or Texas or wherever.
And when you started, Carlina, did you think that you would be training others in aquaculture as well, or were you thinking that this was going to be something that you and your husband were going to just be producing on your own farm?
Actually, we thought we'd be lucky if we sold 5 pounds out the front door. For my husband, it was just having livestock on the property. I actually didn't want anything to do with this when we started. So,
what changed your mind?
Well, I came in to help him on day two, and I've stayed ever since. So I fell in love with every aspect of this. You never have the same day 2 days in a row, ever. Because, like we always tell everybody, the shrimp have never read a book, and they do their own thing. So we have to make sure that their water is where they're going to survive. So it's all about the water.
And people are coming to you, obviously, as you said, folks are driving because they're able to get fresh shrimp, and you really can't compare the taste of fresh shrimp to frozen, in my opinion, anyway. I imagine you feel the same way.
Oh, there's no comparison. I can't eat shrimp anywhere else now. And I know I get called a shrimp snob, but we raised hogs, and I could still eat a pork chop out at a restaurant. I can't eat shrimp anywhere else now.
Carlina, you mentioned your husband in the previous farming that he did. Does he still think of himself as a farmer, or do you all think of this as different?
Yeah, we still farm 2,000 acres of corn and soy, and then we also have an annual perennial greenhouse along with the shrimp farming.
And Bob,
yeah, bringing in oysters also.
Wow. Okay.
Aquaponics. We're expanding.
That sounds like it. We're speaking with Carlina Brown. She's the owner of RDM Shrimp in Northwest Indiana and Fowler. Also on the line with us, Bob Brody from Purdue University's Aquaculture Research Lab. He's the manager there. Bob, how many people are you training at Purdue to work in this industry?
Not that many. We only have probably two or three students per year who target aquaculture. We have, our program is more called aquatic science, so it takes into consideration fisheries, aquatic ecology. It's a very broad spectrum major, but only two or three students actually are interested in doing aquaculture. And generally they come out and work for me as a student worker and get some experience that way. I should say, when you asked, do they consider themselves farmers, RDM, that was one of the reasons I think they were successful doing this, is because they had raised livestock. So they had that perspective of taking care of animals, albeit they were land animals before, but now they have that mindset of how to take care of animals, which made them successful.
And Nathan, when we think about that and we think about how many folks are raising animals here in Illinois, I wonder from DNR's perspective, do you see the aquaculture growing in Illinois? Would you like to see it grow?
Yeah, I think we would. We would like to see it grow. We have some policies and mandates that tell us to encourage aquaculture. But in the end, it's still a private venture, and there's only so much that that we can do to help it. You know, there's still startup costs and other things. And when I take calls, I do point people in the direction of a couple of universities that can help people get started. We don't deal too much in the startup and everything. More of the regulatory and permitting and oversight. I think the going into the future with, on the global scale of food concerns and fishing down the food chain, I think aquaculture has a big future.
That's Nathan Greider. He's the aquaculture project specialist at Illinois DNR on the line from Springfield. I want to thank him, along with Bob Rohde from Purdue University's Aquaculture Research Lab, where he's the manager, and Carlina Brown, who's the owner of RDM Shrimp in Fowler, Indiana. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
No problem.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about the new law that's taken effect in Illinois, allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to become organ donors. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Are you an organ donor? More than 60% of people living in Illinois are, but just until a few months ago, you could only sign up if you were 18 and older. But under a new law that took effect this year, teenagers, 16 and 17-year-olds, can choose to donate their organs through Illinois' database. Illinois now joins the vast majority of other states in doing this. We had been one of three that hadn't allowed teenagers to join the organ donor list. And now that it's allowed, since January, more than 16,000 teenagers have added their names to the list. So how is this affecting people who are awaiting organ transplants? We're going to find out about that now with Kevin Smut. He's president of the Gift of Hope Organ and Tissue Donor Network. He's on the line from Itasca, a suburb northwest of Chicago. Jacob Lanzini is also with us. He's a 17-year-old from Park Ridge, which is just northwest of Chicago as well. Kevin, Jacob, welcome to the 21st. Thanks, both of you, for being here with me.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Jacob, I wonder if you can start by sharing with us your family story of how you got involved with this. This happened before this. You started getting involved with this a couple years ago before you were 17.
Yeah. So about just over three years ago, my dad passed away suddenly from a brain tumor that none of us knew about. It was really sudden, and he was in the hospital, and he died, which was obviously very, very hard on my family. That's how we got introduced to the Gift of Hope, and the name really is fitting. The Gift of Hope is Kevin Smut is the CEO of the primary organ tissue and just transplant, and we got connected to them through my dad's gift, and it really is a gift of hope because with death there's complete and total loss, but this really gave something back to my family as well as the people who received my dad's organs.
Yeah, I'm so sorry for your loss. It sounds like for you all and for your family, though, it was you were able to see how your dad's organs were able to help other people and give them life?
Right, right. And that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that it's beneficial to the people who receive the organs because it saves their lives, but it's also beneficial to the people who lost a loved one because it really is a great thing for us to see.
And Jacob, it sounds like in a way it's been a way to keep your father's memory alive for you all too.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And it's what he wanted. It's what he would have continued to want as well. It really is a testament to the person that he was. And I think it's a great thing to do, and to show just how caring and thoughtful you are as a person. It really is a great thing to do. It's literally potentially could save somebody's life, So
yeah, Jacob, what did it mean to you when the law took effect in January that 16 and 17-year-olds could choose to add themselves to the database, to the registry?
Yeah, it was awesome, and it showed, it made me very happy because, more people's lives will be saved, and the quality of life of people for all around will, improve as well. And it's awful when a tragedy like that happens, and to think about, a 16 or 17-year-old dying, but it does happen sometimes, and for there to be some kind of light at the end of the tunnel helps, you know, us all. So it really meant a lot to me to see that, you know, people were improving as well, progressing and coming and just helping. It's really incredible. Seeing
the amount of people who have signed up too, right, Jacob? And
right.
Kevin, I wanted to ask you about that. It sounds remarkable that 16,000 young people have signed up since January. How did the word get spread for having 16 and 17-year-olds adding their name to the Organ and Tissue Donor Network?
Yeah, so we work closely with the Secretary of State. Jesse White's been a very strong supporter of organ and tissue donation for years. And so the secretary plays a major role in educating his staff at the driver's license facilities to offer this option to 16 and 17 year olds as they come in for their first driver's license. We're also working with high schools, the Illinois High School Athletic Association. We've got a program through several companies that offer driving instruction to young people. To educate about organ and tissue donation so that our 16 and 17-year-olds can make an informed decision when the opportunity to register is put in front of them.
And how many people are registered as donors in Illinois, Kevin?
So a little over 6 million people are registered to be organ and tissue donors in Illinois. That's about 55% or 60% of the people eligible. And it really is, it's important because, you know, Jacob's story is typical. You know, families are faced with a sudden loss of the most important person in their lives. And organ donors are like Jacob's dad. They're not supposed to be dead. They're sudden, they're catastrophic, and families are in an incredible emotional state, and they're thrown a lot of information and asked to make decisions. One of those is about, donating organs and tissues. And having someone in the registry just helps facilitate that discussion. Knowing that your loved one thought about it and wanted to be an organ and tissue donor makes that decision so much easier on a family. And I really, at times, I think I'm just keeping my seat warm for Jacob because he's going to take my job pretty soon. But I think what he said about the impact on donor families is absolutely critical. It's really miraculous. The power of donation and its ability to help families cope and heal with the tragic loss of a loved one. So we really encourage people to think about it and register if they can.
We're speaking with Kevin Smunt. He's president and CEO of the Gift of Hope Organ and Tissue Donor Network. Jacob Lanzini is also on the line with us. Both of them from the Chicago area. We're talking about this issue of organ and tissue donation. Kevin, so there's about 6 million people you said on the list. How many people are waiting for, or how many people are hoping to get organs or needing organs?
Yeah, so there's about 120,000 people nationwide waiting for an organ transplant. Last year, as a nation, we transplanted about 35,000 organs. So there's certainly a greater need than we have the ability to cover at this point. In Illinois, it's about 4,000 people on the wait list. So yeah, we're always in need of additional donations, and although we're very pleased, we've seen about a 60% increase in organ donation in Illinois in the last 5 years. There's still lots of work to do, and we know that we can do even better.
And when you talk about the lots of work to do, I wonder, Kevin, how much you think are there still stigmas when it comes to organ donation?
Yeah, I think there are. Again, you know, when you think about this situation. Every one of these cases is a tragic loss, and you're often faced with a family that's unfamiliar with a hospital setting. Maybe English isn't their first language, so they're in a very uncomfortable position to begin with amongst strangers. They're faced with the loss of the most important person in their lives, and to thrust them into the discussion immediately after they found out that their loved one is brain dead. To make a decision about organ donation is extremely difficult. And there's all kinds of questions about, what is the definition of brain death? And how do I know that my loved one has suffered an irretrievable loss of brain function? And I think, you know, the more education we have of the general public and particularly our hospital partners, the better opportunity we have to offer donation in a setting that's conducive to a good decision.
And do you think there are some myths that still persist around this, or the other education pieces that you think people need to know around this issue, Kevin?
Yeah, I think, you know, probably the single largest is that, you know, if I sign up in the registry, hospitals won't make every effort to save me. And that really couldn't be further from the truth. You know, organ donation, in order to be an organ donor, we have to have heart beating and organs functioning. And so extraordinary measures have to be taken for people who suffered a catastrophic injury in order to make sure that organ donation can happen. And the determination that a person is not going to survive their injuries doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes, you know, days oftentimes where testing is done and you know, decisions can be made. So, you know, really extraordinary life-saving measures are taken in all of these cases. So that's probably the number one myth that we try to dispel.
Jacob, what do you say to folks who, obviously, other than sharing your family story, which is a very powerful one, what kind of things have you said to people who might be hesitant to sign up?
That are hesitant to sign up? Well, I tell them my story, and I attempt to convey to them, you know, how necessary of a thing this is and how life-changing of a thing this is. Not so much for the person that, you know, signs up when they get their license, but the person who may be in, you know, who knows when you pass away, that can receive and have their life changed from your organs. I mean, I met the man with my father's heart, and I met the man with my father's lungs, and they got their lives back. And that's something that my dad didn't have a chance to. There was no coming back from the tumor in his head. And these people were able to come back from the brink of death. And now they continue to live life to its fullest. They have families and grandchildren. And now they don't have to sit idly by on the couch, basically disabled from their, you know, from their conditions. They're able to go out and live their lives. And it's a beautiful thing to see. And, you know, if you... It's the simplest thing to do. You just sign up. You sign up and you can save somebody's life. You know, you can give them that, you can give them their life back. So I really call on everybody to just go online, take the 10 minutes and sign up, because it's that easy.
And Kevin, to Jacob's point, what if for people who are looking for more information, where can they go?
Sure. You can go to our website, which is giftofhope.org, giftofhope.org. There's a button on there that you can click on to register. So I want to be a donor. It probably takes a minute. All you need is your driver's license in your hand. And there's information on our website about donation and statistics and all kinds of things. I guess, you know, I'd really emphasize, you know, if you just ask the general public the question of, when you die, would you like your organs to be used to save someone's life? About 90% of people will say, yes, I'd like to donate my organs. We only get 70% of families to say yes to donation. And I think it's primarily because they just don't know what their loved one wanted. That's why registration is so important. You leave that gift to your family to let them know what your wishes are, so that they're not forced trying to make that decision. You've already made it for them. And so we really encourage people to take a minute or two, go online at giftofhope.org and register to be an organ and tissue donor.
And Kevin, do we have a sense of how many people are in Illinois die each year waiting for an organ transplant?
There's about 300 that die on the wait list every year. And it's a difficult number to determine because some people get taken off the wait list when they're too sick to be transplanted anymore. But, you know, every organ that we recover is really literally saving a life.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing all of that information with us. Jacob, thank you for sharing your story and your family's story. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah, thank you.
We'll have more information on our website about that. If you'd like more information on organ donation, you can visit 21stshow.org. That's also where you can find past shows and information on connecting with us via email, phone, or social media. Coming up on tomorrow's program, when children are traumatized by something like violence in their communities, it can have an effect for years after. It can also make it harder for kids to do well in school and even lead to poor health outcomes later on in life. We'll hear what local educators across Illinois are doing to try to solve the problem and help children traumatized by violence in their communities. So tune in tomorrow for that. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background on what we're talking about. You can also search for our Facebook page. Look for the 21st to like us, and you can send us a message. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or go follow us on social media, just remember our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Tyler Panlilio is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron's our executive editor, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.